Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This edition was produced on Fort William First Nation territory at CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario, by Carly Forbes. I'm your host, Courtney Hara. In this edition,
these toddlers and babies are going to grow up never knowing a time when these ceremonies were forbidden.
The daily threat of detention and deportation led Mrs. Awan to delay treatment.
Canadian Museum for Human Rights had opportunities to build their museum and also allow for a complete and comprehensive archaeological dig, and they refused.
Walking with Our Sisters, an installation honoring the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women, comes to Thunder Bay. The opening of the Human Rights Museum is protested for disrespecting Indigenous people. Mrs. Awan leaves sanctuary in Montreal, and finally, voices from the People's Climate March from Thunder Bay to Denman Island. But first, here are the headlines. Our first headline comes from Aaron Lakoff at CKUT in Montreal, who takes a look at ongoing resistance to tar sands pipelines in Quebec.
Climate justice activists from Quebec began a two-week-long action camp against Enbridge's Line 9 on September 20th. The camp is located along the route of Line 9 on Mohawk territory in Saint-André-d'Argenteuil, about 1 hour northwest of Montreal. Around 50 people were at the opening of the camp to help with the setup, and organizers are expecting up to 200 more in attendance over the weekend. The camp is being hosted on the land of Claire du Rocher, who has already had a Line 9 oil spill on her property. Groundwire spoke with Alyssa Simons-Bélanger, one of the organizers of the camp. She told us about why people should be concerned about Enbridge's plan to reverse the flow of Line 9.
So Enbridge Line 9 right now goes from Montreal to Sarnia, and it already had, it just in the Line 9B, so this is the pipeline that runs through Quebec, there's already been 12 spills that we've been able to locate. And this is conventional oil that goes through this pipeline. So the reversal of the pipeline, that means the oil will go from Sarnia to the refineries in Montreal, will transport bitumen. It's a non-conventional oil that when it spills in water, it will not float on top of the water, but it will sink in the bottom, just like what we've seen, what happened in Kalamazoo in Michigan in 2010, when millions of liters of oil went into the Kalamazoo River, and that today we are still picking up the spill that is very much impossible to be able to clean it well.
To get involved in the Line 9 camp in Quebec, or to get more information, call 438-937-0249 or search Camp Line 9 on Facebook. For Groundwire, this is CKUT's Aaron Lakoff reporting from Montreal.
Our next headline reflects on the one-year anniversary of the migrant strike. Carly Forbes brings us this headline with files from Dan Keller.
September 17th marked 1 year since the beginning of the hunger strike by people being held in immigration detention in Lindsay, Ontario. The day was marked by actions in four different cities in Ontario and Quebec. In Montreal, there was a demonstration at the Laval Immigration Detention Center. People in Guelph took place in a creative action at the farmers market, and in Ottawa, there was an action at the Canadian Border Services Agency headquarters, and a community feast. In Toronto, there was a block party in the streets, and people of color and Indigenous artists performed. Dan Keller from the Grand River Media Co-op, CKMS Waterloo, spoke with Tings from the End Immigration Detention Network.
So we're doing all of these actions across Ontario and in Montreal because we're really needing to celebrate the courageous acts of resistance that immigration detainees have been taking for the past year. Not only do they have a hunger strike, the longest of which the hunger strikers lasted for 65 days, they've also done things like boycotted their detention reviews, they refused to go on lockdown, And these really courageous actions that we, on the outside, really need to be supporting.
On September 25th, a secret Red Cross report was leaked to the public about the deplorable conditions of immigration detention in Canada. They cited that there was an increasing detention of minors, frequent overcrowding, including triple bunking in some cases, and a need for alternatives to detention. Earlier this year in July, the UN also released a similar report. Additionally, they called for an immediate release of Michael Magovo, who's been detained for over 8 years.
Daniel Segay from No One Is Illegal Vancouver contextualizes recent Canadian citizenship issues with Megan Thomas at CJSF.
The inquest into the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez while in Canadian Border Service Agency custody is scheduled to begin Monday, September 29th and continue through October 3rd, 2014. On December 28, 2013, 42-year-old hotel worker Lucia Vega Jimenez died in hospital after hanging herself while in custody at the immigration center at the Vancouver airport. Her immigration status had been revealed during a stop by TransLink police. Coroner and police were notified at the time, but her death was not reported by public channels. Immigration lawyer Phil Rankin described the Vancouver airport facility to the Globe and Mail as a dungeon that is completely isolated. He called it the most isolated place in Canada. Following public calls, the BC Coroner's Service has announced an inquest into Vega Jimenez's death. The BC CLA and the Canadian Council of Refugees have been granted participant status in the inquest, but as of September 15th, several community groups, including the Coalition for Immigrant Rights, which includes Latin American community members, and migrant groups in Vancouver, who were calling for the inquest, were denied participation. The Mexican consulate has reportedly declined to participate. No One Is Illegal Vancouver collective member Daniel Segay commented on what the denial of participation of community groups indicates about the relationship between the CBSA and these groups.
Many immigrant and refugee groups who were involved in organizing memorials, gathering information, pressuring the government into even having an inquest or addressing this issue or raising the issue. These very groups have been shut out from the inquest. This decision, I think, exemplifies that the CBSA is really uncomfortable with groups who could challenge them, who could make them feel kind of very guilty about the things they're doing, because the CBSA would have to look in the very people they detain and exploit in the face. Lucia Jimenez died in an indefinite detention center. Indefinite detention is something that's occurring a lot more in Canada. There would be fewer deaths and fewer people going the way of Lucia if there were fewer instances of people being put in immigration detention center, fewer instances of people being threatened with deportation.
In a September 15th BC Civil Liberties Association media release, Executive Director of the BC CLA, Josh Patterson, noted the goals of their participation, including knowing if Jimenez's death could have been prevented, the role of private security company Genesis Security, who is contracted to supervise detainees, what access Jimenez had to mental health and medical support, why her death was not reported to the public for a month, and if any agreement has been made with the family after Jimenez's death. The inquest into Jimenez's death cannot find fault, but can determine facts and make recommendations. You can find the petition for independent civilian inquest on change.org. This is Megan Thomas reporting for Groundwire from CJSF Burnaby, unceded Coast Salish territories.
Now it's time for our feature stories. Khurshid Begum Awan came to Canada in 2011 from Pakistan. After spending nearly 1 year behind church walls with her daughter and grandson by her side, she presented herself to Citizenship and Immigration Canada to obtain her pre-removal risk assessment application, which could regularize her status. On September 22nd, CKUT's Leila Lemglaf attended a press conference on the matter in Montreal.
The fate of refugee Khurshid Begum Awan remains a concern to her relatives and the larger network looking out for her. The Pakistani woman spent the past year in sanctuary at a Montreal church and is now in hospital with a grave heart condition.
The Awan family's struggle unfolds against a backdrop of escalating attacks against migrants and refugees. Just 1 year after the implementation of Bill C-31, widely referred to as the Refugee Exclusion Act, we have witnessed the number of refugee claims plummeting by 50%, while the acceptance rate has dropped to a historic low of 33%. Since then, an estimated 9,000 migrants have been detained and 14,000 deported, an average of 40 per day. Dozens of families have also opted to forego their freedom of movement and seek sanctuary in churches across the country. For the Awan family, the past year in sanctuary has forced them to contend with a number of difficult conditions. The daily threat of detention and deportation led Mrs. Awan to delay treatment, to defer necessary medical follow-up, and to deliberate endlessly as to whether or not to seek care when confronted with a number of health emergencies.
Speaking on behalf of the family's support committee, Amy Darwish expressed ongoing hope that Mrs. Awan will be granted permanent resident status in Canada. Refugee legal aids have highlighted a humanitarian SOS for migrants living without status and have been upfront in their statements that Canada practices racist and exclusionary immigration law. Appeals for the family's reunification in Canada are based on the desire to right a wrong. Stuart Ishtvanfi is Awan's lawyer.
This woman is a victim of very serious Islamic terrorism in Lahore, Pakistan. There's very, very strong evidence in support of this, which we have been presenting on more than one occasion over the last year. The case has very strong support from the highest level of different human rights organizations there, lawyers, neighbors, lots and lots of evidence to show that a mistake has been made. But unfortunately, we are in a situation where the Canadian government does not believe in correcting mistakes. The case also raises the question of whether there's a valid recourse in this country to enforce the protection of family life and the best interests of the children. In many international conventions, Canada has signed on to the respect for family life. But in this case, we have a daughter, a grandson, who are living here, who are willing to take care of her, who want to have her here. They're just ignoring this completely. Now, I would like to conclude by thanking Bishop Clark and the people in different churches in this country and the communities of faith that are rallying around to respect Christian values and to respect basic moral values that our government appears to have abandoned. Really, we are in a situation where this government has abandoned our human rights traditions, has abandoned our humanitarian traditions, and Mrs. Awan is a victim of this decision to show just great inhumanity towards people who are asking for the protection of this country.
Awan's daughter, Tyra, came to Canada 14 years ago. She and her son are Canadian citizens.
I just request for the immigration to please try to understand and please, I want to my mom save life, in his life and my son's life. That are my request. I don't need anything. Only I need my mom and my father and my son.
For Groundwire, I'm Leila Lemglev in Montreal with CKUT News.
Walking with Our Sisters is a commemorative art installation traveling across Turtle Island for the next 7 years, honoring the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women. Carly Forbes spoke with two members of the National Collective.
Walking with Our Sisters is bringing intergenerational community members together through ceremony in communities across Turtle Island. Erin Marie Consmo, a National Collective member, shared some background on the project.
Tense, Erin Marie Consmo, Nitsigasun, Manitou, Sagahigan, Ochinia. My name is Erin Marie, and I'm from Laxana in Alberta. And I'm the youth coordinator and media contact on the Walking with Our Sisters National Collective. So Walking with Our Sisters is a commemorative art installation to remember and honor the lives of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And this commemorative art installation started with beading circles, with community getting together and beading the tops of moccasins, also known as vamps or uppers. And we now have close to 1,800 moccasin tops. And those moccasin tops represent the unfinished lives of Indigenous women and girls. And this sacred bundle is traveling for 7 years, so up until 2019, across more than 30 communities in both Canada and the U.S. And what has come of Walking with Our Sisters after, we're now in our seventh community here in Thunder Bay, what has now come out of this traveling and out of this process is a recognition that this sacred bundle and this lodge are really based around ceremony and having a space for a community to honor those that are still missing or that have been lost.
Kara Ludit is a co-lead organizer of the local committee here in Thunder Bay and is now also a member of the National Collective. Both Kara and Erin spoke to the importance of youth participation and the ways that youth are taking leadership in walking with our sisters.
Hey, my name is Kara Ludit. My spirit name is Askiokamaskwe, which means Earth Boss Woman. I am Sturgeon Clan from Fort Albany First Nation. I love how everything is in ceremony and seeing these young people around it, being surrounded by it, and especially seeing some of these toddlers and the babies that come through. These toddlers and babies are going to grow up never knowing a time when these ceremonies were forbidden. And that's something really powerful that I hope that this will continue to really move forward.
You know, walking with our sisters is a huge opportunity over the next 7 years to really do some youth resurgence and reclamation of Indigenous knowledge in our nations, because our young people are going to be the ones that are eventually our elders and the people that are, you know, that will have to carry the culture and the languages and the ceremonies. And, you know, I think that, you know, we often speak about, you know, looking forward to the seventh generation. And I think that, you know, since this bundle is traveling for 7 years as well, like, there's a huge opportunity for our communities and for all of these more than 30 communities to do that work. This is, and it's done in a sustainable way, because it's not just one night or one day. It's sustained over several months of community coming together over beat-ins, around sharing circles, around community conversations that each community has to hold before they even accept this bundle, to prepare themselves to have those tough conversations about what's happening in community, you know, what's happening with young people. And it changes for every single community, right? Like, intergenerational organizing and meaningful youth engagement looks different every single place. It has some of the same elements, but it looks different everywhere. And I think that that's going to be something that's really amazing. And I've been seeing that, you know, young people are drawn to this bundle because of the ways that it just accepts people for who they are and where they're at. And so I think that walking with our sisters is a good model for communities who want to support meaningful engagement of young people and creation of leadership opportunities as well.
We've had some wonderful young men come out throughout this whole week of installation, and being able to see them paired up with elders, whether it was helping to make tobacco ties or birch bark spirit dish offerings, just everything involved with the ceremony, with the bundle, and having the youth really become involved was something beautiful to see.
Visit walkingwithoursisters.ca for more information about the project. On October 4th, in communities across Turtle Island, Sisters in Spirit will be hosting vigils to honor the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Look for listings in a community near you. I'm Carly Forbes, reporting for Groundwire from Anishinaabe Territory in Thunder Bay.
The Winnipeg-based Canadian Museum for Human Rights opened to the public for the first time on Saturday, September 27th. A recent controversy has erupted over speculation the museum did not respect human rights in the very construction of the building, as it is being built on one of the most archaeologically rich sites in the country. CKUW's Michael Welsh brings us this report.
For years, the project known as the Canadian Museum for Human Rights has been dogged by criticism. Some Indigenous solidarity groups, for example, point out the hypocrisy of our governments being able to finance such an expensive project. The museum's capital costs alone stand at $351 million, but not meet the basic needs of some of the most vulnerable members of our society. But does the creation and construction of the building housing the museum itself constitute an act of cultural violence? This is the point of an article appearing on alternative news sites Rabble and Intercontinental Cry. The author, Kim Lee Wong, a Sagging First Nation member and a former investigative reporter with the Aboriginal People's Television Network, explains.
The Canadian Museum for Human Rights had opportunities to build their museum and also allow for a complete and comprehensive archaeological dig, and they refused. And this was very early on. So right from there, from that decision, it shows me that there wasn't a lot of real, meaningful respect given to local Indigenous people's heritages and histories and ancestors. And then when I look at that museum, I think of all the public money that has gone into that museum. And meanwhile, there are cuts on health and education, affordable housing, on getting food, on youth programs, on counseling services.
The Canadian Museum for Human Rights itself disclosed a report about the rich archaeological finds at the site of the museum. Angela Cassie is a spokesperson for the museum. She explains that the museum consulted extensively with the First Nations elders and with archaeological authorities. She denies there was a lack of care with regard to the artifacts uncovered.
It was supervised, and we did 4 years of archaeological work throughout the construction of the project. It's the largest undertaking of its kind ever in Manitoba, and there is a rich amount of finding that is available now for research, and it has really informed our knowledge and our knowledge about the history of the site.
Kim Lee Wong's critical views on the museum were based on an interview she conducted with Dr. Lee Sims, a retired archaeology professor with 40 years of experience in the field and with a special focus on the pre-contact First Nations societies in Manitoba. He's considered an authority in his field. He explains that the Forks had been recognized as one of the richest archaeological sites in Manitoba, if not the country, and that in his view, the museum directors did not exercise the diligence they should have in protecting the artifacts uncovered.
Part of the problem is that they did a block excavation in the first year, but a lot of the excavation was things like the holes for the pilings, 24-inch deep, 24-inch wide circular holes for the pilings scattered around. So it's kind of like putting a pin in a forest sort of thing, a handful of pins, and hoping you find something. And that's part of the problem with the second report, is that they couldn't tie things from level to level sort of thing. They also changed their strategy. Initially, when they started off in 2008, there are, for example, just hundreds of meters of lines, hydro lines, water lines, telephone lines, all these underground lines.
Oh, yeah.
And in 2008, they were going to carefully excavate down at one end, excavate underneath the occupations, and come up the other side. So they destroyed a small area. In 2009, they decided that was too much problem, and so they just took them out with backhoe. I mean, there should have been excavations ongoing for 3 years before they even started, and there should have been large crews right through till 2011, and there weren't. It was a pathetically inadequate sample, and certainly is no way representative of what's there. And there's great, great gaps in the knowledge that we will never have in terms of First Nations at the Forks. Friends of the Human Rights Museum, their obsession or their focus was raising $300 million.
It is possible the museum may indeed serve as an important opportunity for peoples to come together to discuss human rights, and may even provide a much-needed venue for uncomfortable conversations about ongoing human rights abuses happening with the silent consent of good Canadians. But for now, at least, museum defenders do not as yet seem to express any contrition for the loss of a unique deposit of archaeological treasures enabled by the realization of Mr. Asper's dream. From downtown Winnipeg in the heart of Anishinaabe Aki, homeland of the Métis and traditional territory of the Niuwak and the Nakota, this is CKUW's Michael Welch reporting for Groundwire.
That report was put together with the assistance of audio recorded from Kim Lee Wong. And now, hear voices from the People's Climate March that took place in over 2,500 cities around the world on Sunday, September 21st. First, Frieda Warden brings us voices from the walk on Denman Island.
I'm walking up the hill to the community hall where the climate march on Denman Island is about to take place. Hi. So how many people do you think are here?
I'd say there's about 25 or 30 people here today,
yeah?
Which is great for Denman Island. And solidarity with all the rest of the people around the world who are marching for climate action. A lot of people in Denman Island live that kind of lifestyle. They grow their own food and live simply and close to home, and we're trying to show by our actions that we're in favor of cutting back on fossil fuels. And my sign says, cook kale, not our earth.
Hi.
What I have here is some water that's a collection of very special water. We've got some rainwater and some lake water and some well water. And we've talked about water and we danced around water, and now we're going to bring this water and put it in the ocean water.
Do you have a comment about the overarching meaning?
I think this little sign at the top of my sign says it all. Say no to CO2-linization. About colonization being connected to the destruction of the planet and the preciousness of water being sort of affected by our continued colonization in this country. You know, the resource extraction and suppression of human rights, all connected.
This is a good morning for the planet. We're all in the same boat now. We're all here together walking on this road, not driving, and not burning any fossil fuels. We're walking. I like that sign that somebody's carrying saying, Harper does less with more. I think we need a new leader, a greener leader than Mr. Harper.
We are marching to Victoria, Victoria, Victoria. We are marching to Victoria as we march along.
And now we'll go to audio from the People's Climate March in Thunder Bay, recorded by Carly Forbes.
Obviously, you're all here because you care about the planet and your kids and your grandkids and their grandkids.
Dr. Cynthia Wesley Esquimaux is the Vice Provost of Aboriginal Initiatives, and she's going to speak on some of the impacts and the relevance to First Nations people, where this pipeline and where the tar sands actually have already done some damage.
So thank you so much for coming out and supporting this initiative. As they've said, this is happening all around the world, and thank goodness for that, and it's about time that we actually realize that the only way we're going to make the changes that we need to see in this world is by acting together. And there are 34 million people in Canada. There are 2 million of those are Indigenous peoples. They are fighting very hard to protect the territories up here in the north. 90% of the population north of 60 is Indigenous. And they're not only protecting the lands and the waters for their own futures, they're really protecting it for all of Canada. And I think we need to get behind that.
Rodney Brown sing Freight Train Derailed live at the People's Climate March in Thunder Bay. That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced on Fort William First Nations territory at CILU in Thunder Bay, Ontario, by Carly Forbes. Music this week was by Rodney Brown. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lakoff, Megan Thomas, and Carly Forbes. We also thank Leela Lemgleff, Michael Welch, Dan Keller, Mina Ramos, and Groundwire's new national coordination team, Audrey O'Bram, Courtney Harrop, and Ophira Horwitz. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.